Good morning. My name is Sandy Dolby, and yes, that's me standing in the courtyard of Queens College, one of about two dozen colleges that comprise the University of Cambridge, which is located about an hour's train ride from London. I'm a member of Pacific Beach United Methodist Church, and this past summer I had the extraordinary opportunity to study for a few weeks at Cambridge. Pastor April asked me to speak about that experience today, and since my talk is free, I just want to remind you of something up front. You get what you pay for. The program I was a part of was funded by the Templeton Foundation, which is known for asking the big picture questions. And the big picture question here was the intersection of science and religion. I was one of 10 journalists, science writers and religion writers, who spent 8 weeks immersed in these two subjects. Each of us also pursued individual projects of our own choosing. Cambridge was amazing. Its history goes back 800 years. Its lineage includes more than 80 Nobel Prize winners. The days were packed with lectures from renowned experts. They introduced me to the string theory, the Big Bang, to parallel universes. I introduced them to country singer Carrie Underwood. And that probably goes a long way in explaining why America has a trade deficit. One of the first things I did after I arrived at Cambridge, this prestigious world-class university, was to go to a pub. Now, it was in the name of research. It was called the Eagle Pub. And the Eagle Pub is historic because at one point the Cavendish Science Laboratory was located nearby. And so all the scientists would go there and hang out. In the winter of 1953, when Dr. Francis Crick discovered DNA with his colleague Dr. James Watson, Crick thundered into the Eagle Pub and exclaimed, "I have unlocked the secret of life." Now, that's not the end of the story. After he had delivered this amazing pronouncement, a discovery for which he would later win a Nobel Prize, the pub waitress walked up to him and said something to this effect: "Bully for you, Francis Crick, but until you pay your tab, you shan't get another pint of ale from me." That brings me to today's scripture reading. It's in the book of Matthew. The Gospel of Matthew, according to Matthew, the first book of the New Testament, it's in the 22nd chapter, verses 15 to 22. Most scholars believe that this gospel was written by Matthew, the disciple of Jesus, who was formerly known as Levi. And you might remember he was a tax collector before he was a disciple. And that probably explains why he chose to include this confrontation in his account of Jesus' ministry, when none of the other Gospels mention it. In this story, Jesus is traveling around teaching a rather radical message of sense and sensibility when some of the upper echelon decide they want to try to trap him, to trip him up. So they go to him and they say, "Teacher, we know you are truthful. Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay Caesar or not?" Now, remember, they were there for a gotcha moment. But instead, Jesus, who kind of knew what they were up to, asked to see the coin. He held it up and he said, "Whose image and inscription is on this coin?" And they answered, "Caesar's." And then Jesus told them, "Give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." The Bible says that when they heard this answer, they were so amazed that they walked away in silence. When Pastor April returns next week, she can correct my theology, for I am a simple layperson, a recovering journalist. But this week, I will tell you that one of the things this passage says to me is that Jesus is telling us to participate in the world, that we must be part of the real world as well as God's world. While his enemies were trying to trip him up through their own rigid rules and regulations, he was saying that both worlds can live together. God is bigger than all these petty divisions. I think Sir Isaac Newton understood this. This portrait of Newton hangs in the headmaster's apartment at Trinity College in Cambridge, where Newton was a fellow in the 17th century. Outside that apartment is a lovely private garden area where there is planted the graft of the graft of the graft of the graft of the apple tree that Isaac Newton supposedly sat under when the notion of gravity literally fell upon him. Now, you may know Newton as a mathematician and a physicist, but did you also know he was a theologian? He lived in a world smitten with both the science and the sacred. He once said, "We build too many walls and not enough bridges." Centuries later, this is still the case. Science and religion have not played well in the sandbox we call life for a long, long time. As I walked through the garden and I looked at this tree, I could not help but wonder where we have gone wrong. Christians, Jews, and Muslims are often called people of the book because our faiths believe in some version of the Bible. So when did the people of the book become so afraid of books? When did the truth stop setting Christians free? Why have we built walls instead of bridges between faith and science? When did Darwin become the devil and people of faith become seen as anti-intellectuals? These questions led me to the project I pursued on the science of forgiveness. It's a relatively new field of research that is giving a secularized jumpstart to an ancient religious virtue. I called my project In Search of the F Word. As a journalist covering religion and ethics back then, I had written about the science of forgiveness effort in bits and snatches over the last several years. But this fellowship gave me a block of time to truly devote to the subject. One of the things I discovered was that the father of the science of forgiveness movement was not a scientist at all. He was a theologian and a Protestant pastor named Lewis Smedes. Dr. Smedes died a few years ago, and he used to be a professor at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena. And that's when he began to pursue this subject of forgiveness. He understood the religious significance. He knew that in Buddhism, it is one of the pathways on the journey to enlightenment. He knew that in the Quran, heaven is the reward for people who forgive. And he knew that in Judaism, forgiveness is a central tenet of the Hebrew scriptures for living justly and keeping the peace. And of course, he knew that in Christianity, forgiveness is so crucial that Jesus not only taught about it in his 3 years of ministry, but he made it part of his model prayer. And then he became the ultimate role model of it in his death. Remember what he said on the cross? "Forgive them, Father. They do not know what they're doing." Dr. Smedes knew all this, but through his own work and experiences, he was convinced that forgiveness was good for the forgiver. So in the 1980s, he went to some of his social science friends and said, "Look, what are you waiting for? Go prove it." Science, meanwhile, had been nibbling around the edges of this idea. In the 1950s, researchers took a group of factory workers from Western Electric in Chicago and rated their hostility level, ranking them from the highest to the lowest in stress, anger, holding a grudge, and so forth. They went back to that same group in the 1970s and studied their medical files. Now, since I wanted to impress my Cambridge instructors and my fellow fellows, as I was preparing my presentation for that final week there, I painstakingly translated the findings of all this research into this sophisticated formula in my next slide. 20 years later, those who had been angry over that period of time were either dead or were suffering serious ailments. Studies like this one, along with Lewis Mead's call to arms, unleashed a tsunami of forgiveness research. By the 1990s, the science of forgiveness was in full swing, and scientists were giddy, well, as much as scientists can be giddy, with the results. As they compared the control groups of those who had been taught forgiveness and had exhibited forgiveness to the other groups of people who had not shown forgiveness and were not taught it. In study after study, they found that forgiving people were found to be more healthy mentally, more satisfied, less depressed. A study of twins showed those who forgave were less likely to be smokers or to take drugs. HIV and AIDS patients who had forgiven were better off because they showed that they were more faithful to their drug regimen and to their health. Even people who had suffered spinal cord injuries reported better results in their recuperation and their therapy if they had exhibited forgiveness. So guess what happened next? Yep, a whole library of how-to books. Enough to fill one side of the pew to the other. Oh, and you see the one at the bottom center with the black cover? It's kind of out of focus. It's called A Handbook of Forgiveness. Now, when I ordered this on Amazon.com, I was pretty jazzed. I mean, a handbook, that would be kind of cool, a little glossary that I could take out and kind of read and know exactly what all the research was. And then it arrived, and I opened up the box. The Handbook of Forgiveness is nearly 600 pages long without pictures. Early on into my time at Cambridge, I got to listen to Ken Pargament, a clinical psychologist and a professor at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, who has done extensive research on forgiveness and spirituality. And so the Cambridge Fellow Program brought him to talk to us. He's a very likable, down-to-earth guy who routinely does spiritual biographies with his patients so he can help them find common ground toward healing. One evening, I was delighted to see that I was seated next to Ken during one of the formal college dinners that had become a regular ritual. After my second glass of wine, I worked up the nerve to ask him why science needed to get into the forgiveness business. I asked him, I said, Ken, isn't this the purview of religion? I mean, look at the world's largest religion, Christianity. Jesus was the king of forgiveness. Why do Christians need mental health professionals? Ken leaned forward, tapped me on the shoulder, and gave me his answer. You're not Jesus, he told me. And if you think that's funny, guess what? You're not Jesus either. And because we are not Jesus, because forgiveness doesn't come naturally to us, because make my day and kiss my grits have trumped turn the other cheek, we need all the help we can get to learn how to forgive. Now, I noticed in my readings and in my interviews of researchers that when they speak of forgiveness, they tend to start with what forgiveness isn't. Forgiveness is not pretending the offense didn't happen, or that it didn't matter, or dismissing it. You are not a doormat. Remember, you were created in God's image. Forgiving is not making excuses. Officer, he wouldn't have hit me if I hadn't made him mad. You're not a punching bag. You were created in God's image. And social scientists also will tell you that forgiving is not instant. You can't just add water and stir. While you are created in God's image, remember, you're not Jesus. While I was at Cambridge, I got to meet Julie Epstein, who is a psychologist at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. She was there for the summer doing some research. Dr. Exline is adamant that forgiveness is not something else. It's not about putting you in harm's way. You don't leave your brains at the door, she said. She uses herself as an example. Her first marriage was an abusive one. Her husband was violent, so violent that she left him when he was out of town on a business trip, and she never let him know where she was living. Eventually, she did forgive him. But even then, her forgiveness was sent via a letter delivered by her mother-in-law. And while forgiveness cannot lead always to, and while I should say forgiveness sometimes leads to reconciliation, that is not always the case. Dr. Exline is happily married to someone else. What forgiveness is, according to the researchers, is it's the letting go of the bitterness, the anger, and the resentment around the offense. Feelings and behaviors that can be harmful to your physical and mental health. And in study after study, there was another common element that they found, and that was empathy. The understanding of another person's situation, another person's feelings, and another person's motivations. In my project, I featured five people who had forgiven their offenders. One was a man named Paul Livingston, who is from San Diego. He forgave the now dead school custodian who had repeatedly raped him when he was a little boy. By letting go, Paul found himself freed to heal, and he also started to think of that man and say to himself, what a terrible childhood he must have had to have learned these things as a boy. Another was Immaculee Ilibagaza. Mrs. Ilibagaza now lives in New York State, but she used to live in Rwanda, and she survived the genocide there, hidden in a pastor's bathroom for 3 months with seven other women. She later came face to face with the man who butchered her mother and brother. He was in the prison then, by then, and he was in rags. And when she went to meet him, she recognized him as a neighbor. She also recognized that he was frightened and hurting, just as she once had been. She looked into his troubled face and she said simply, I forgive you. The third person was another San Diego man named Azim Kamisa. He's a Sufi Muslim who lost his only son when he was shot to death one night while delivering pizzas by a teenage gangbanger. In his forgiveness, Azim decided that there were two victims at both ends of the gun that night. The fourth was a man named Jim LaRue, who lives in Ohio, and his only daughter was killed by a serial killer while she was hiking the Appalachian Trail. His forgiveness came in the form of a letter read at the killer's sentencing hearing several years later because Jim LaRue realized it was eating him up. The fifth person was the editor of that book I talked about, The Handbook of Forgiveness, Dr. Everett Worthington. He's one of the most famous pioneers in the forgiveness of movements. He's the head of the psychology department at Virginia Commonwealth University and is well respected in his field. But on New Year's Eve, 1995, his work was put to a horrible test. His mother was brutally murdered in her home. I was furious, Dr. Worthington told me. I was doing all the things that first day that anyone else does. I had not let myself think the word forgiveness all day. Now, for someone who deals with forgiveness full time for 2 decades, that's quite telling. The police called him and asked him to go to his mother's home, now a crime scene, to identify anything that might have been stolen. As he was walking through it, room to room, Dr. Worthington noticed that every mirror was smashed. And he started thinking to himself, What must this killer had been thinking of himself to not want to look at his image anywhere? And yes, he began to feel a kind of empathy for the man who took his mother's life. Empathy is not about approving what they did, Dr. Worthington told me. It's about understanding why they did it. When I asked him if he believes science has proven forgiveness is good for us, his answer struck me as particularly poignant. He said, "Sandy, as a scientist and as a person, I say, yeah, I think the evidence is pretty strong that it has more benefits than it has harm." So there you have it, the joining together of two great disciplines, science at one end, religion at the other end, toward a common goal of forgiveness, learning about it, studying it, teaching it. What is the future of this forgiveness movement? Dr. Fred Luskin at Stanford University is taking it into the workplace and into the schools. He would like the houses of worship to get more involved as well, with practical how-to classes that combine theology and reality. Of course, God knows we at PBUMC could never use a forgiveness class. We don't need to forgive anybody in our church, right? Sitting on the steps at Stanford with him, Dr. Luskin was thinking out loud about what our culture would be like if we were more forgiving as children, more forgiving of our bosses and our colleagues at work, more forgiving of our religious differences, of our political differences, more forgiving of other countries. In a few moments, we will join together to sing a hymn that was written by a woman who came to realize in her despair that the peace that passes understanding, and perhaps the forgiveness that passes understanding as well, begins not just with prayer, but also with each of us. Dear God, thank you for your blessings, for the miracles of science as well as the miracles of faith. Help us to build bridges and melt walls, to remember our soul and our intellect are one in the spirit and in the flesh. We ask for your solace for those suffering loss today, for those looking at new beginnings, for those who are traveling, who are ill, and for all of us as we face the storms of life on Wall Street, Main Street, and even here on Thomas Avenue. Remind us of what is truly important as we repeat the prayer that Jesus taught us 2,000 years ago. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory.